Welcome to Join the Conversation, a podcast of the Student Housing Matters blog. Join the Conversation features interviews with higher education leaders, authors, and influencers on a variety of topics relevant to anyone involved with on-campus housing. Joining us on the podcast today is college instructor and veteran business writing and presentation skills coach, Dr. Wilma Davidson. Dr. Davidson is an instructor of professional and technical communications at the University of South Florida and author of the third revised edition of Business Writing, What Works, What Won't, published by St. Martin's Griffin. Dr. Davidson was kind enough to speak with us today about the importance of attaining good writing skills and what that means for professionals everywhere, including higher education.
Hello, Wilma, and welcome to Join the Conversation.
Thanks very much. I'm really happy to talk writing anytime anybody wants me to.
Well, great. Well, the third edition of your book, Business Writing, What Works and What Won't, was released this year. And I read in one description that, quote, it demystifies the writing process for people so they can build self-confidence, end quote. How do you think you've been able to accomplish this?
I think perhaps the best way that I get people to feel more confident about their writing is to get them to realize that they have permission to say it the wrong way before they say it the right way. And so many people think that, you know, writing pops out of your forehead perfectly onto the page, and that just isn't the way it happens. So the ability to say it, it's not this mystical gift that some people have and some people don't. You know, it's not a God-given talent, although perhaps it is for many, but it really is a learned skill. And it's a lifelong skill, so people can get better at it all the time. And once people realize that, you know, maybe all good writers were bad writers first, they seem to relax about it. And once they understand what the process is all about and accept it, they realize that, you know, it isn't so terrifying. It doesn't need to be.
Well, you know, that's interesting because in the introduction to your book, you explain why you wrote it and you tell the story of how we go from children scribbling joyously with crayons to adults, sometimes gripped by terror, staring at a blank page or a screen. What happens to take us to that place and what does your book do to change that?
Well, I think that what happens in schools is that teachers feel that they have to correct for every mistake a student makes. And I think that the problem in doing that is that correcting writing then becomes not the same thing as teaching writing. And teaching writing means giving students lots of opportunities, not all of which have to be graded, you know, to write and to know that sometimes, you know, like a baseball player, sometimes they're going to strike out, sometimes they're going to hit a double, or sometimes they're going to hit a home run. And I think once we realize that students need to learn to value writing, to realize that writing can answer a real need that they have, can help them solve a problem, can help them get the job done, and that it's not always just for the teacher and just for a grade. And trying to get people to realize that, you know, writing isn't just that. It isn't just something you do for a grade. It can help you talk your homeowners association into doing something that you want to do. It can help someone that you care for a great deal know how much you care for them. It can, you know, help you voice your own beliefs about things. So once you can give students the belief that their writing can accomplish things besides a grade and it has value, I think that we can get back to, you know, to that place where writing can be joyous. Now, I don't promise that I get people, every person who is in my class or who reads the book to absolutely fall in love with writing. But I do believe I get people to hate it less. And so I count that as a victory.
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting thought. You talked about correcting writing and teaching writing. Do you think that there's a flaw in the educational model of teaching students how to write?
Well, yes, I do. As I said earlier, that there are well-intentioned teachers. Oftentimes they, you know, have to teach for the test, but I think that in their desire to do what they believe is the right thing, you know, they have to find every error that a student makes. And I think that you have to start where the student is and realize what's the bigger issue that the student has in this particular paper, not what is every mistake in this paper, and try to correct for that and move the student from where the student is more toward perfection. But perfection isn't as much the goal as growth should be the goal. And I think that when a teacher takes that red pen, you know, to the paper, then what happens is that, you know, the student just doesn't know where to go with all of the input, rather than starting with what might be the three biggest areas to work with. And then once those are tackled and fixed, move on to the finer things. I think that when you're learning to write, you want to grow as a writer. And you can't grow when you try to correct everything at the same time.
Well, you know, that leads me to the next question. Your book talks about that there are three premises that you say energize not only your book, but the workshops that you do. And one of those is a quote that is as follows. We learn to write by groping uncomfortably, even chaotically, for a time without fear of reprisal. Why do you think most of us have it in our minds that if we can't write effortlessly and painlessly, that we're not good writers?
I think because most people just see the finished product of a writer. You know, they see the final copy of my book. They don't see the earlier versions. We think that writing somehow, you know, comes out of the forehead onto the page, and it's just errorless, it's just perfect. And that is not how writing really happens. And I think part of the reason is that, let's take a normal, let's say, English classroom. The instructor may assign, you know, an essay for that particular class period. And what is the teacher doing while the students are trying to write that essay? The teacher is normally, you know, sitting at the desk, maybe reading other papers, reading a book, doing something, but rarely is the teacher actually doing the assignment with the students. So students rarely have a model, a role model, that they see as a writer who goes through the same pains and trials and tribulations that other writers, you know, that others really go through. So I think they have a diminished picture of, you know, of what good writing is. It is not the art of writing is not in the writing. It's in the revision. And I think that we need to show students that it takes a long while to get it right, and that is part of the process. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's usually how it happens. As I said earlier, we usually write it wrong before we write it right.
Part 6 of your book outlines a 3-phase process for what you call writing quickly and well. Describe that process for our listeners.
Well, I like to think of the process as having 3 phases to it. And often what happens with writers who really hate to write or who struggle enormously with it is that they tend to take a process, which is, the literature will tell you, a process that is largely recursive. We move in and out all the time of creating and editing and organizing, et cetera. We're always moving back and forth between all of those. You know, it's like putting your fingers to the typewriter and writing two words or I'm typewriter, I'm aging myself here, to either the typewriter or to the computer, and you write three words, and then 2 seconds later you have deleted those three words, and you've said to yourself, oh, that's stupid, that's wrong, or I got to start over again. And that's because you're creating, and 2 seconds later you're revising what you created, and then, you know, a few seconds later you're saying, oh, that doesn't go there, that goes somewhere else. So this, the recursive nature of the process is not very friendly to the process. So the process that I've come up with, I call it deadline writing, because oftentimes, especially in, you know, the real world, we are writing under deadlines, is to take this recursive process, it goes back and forth and back and forth like a pretzel, and instead make it more linear, starting with the first phase of it, which should be the, as I call it in the book, the helter-skelter writing. It's the creation of that very first fast draft, the draft that's not going to be the final draft, but it's trying to take your, whatever time you have to write. You got an essay due, it's due, you know, in an hour, you know, divide that time into three 20-minute sections. Spend 20 minutes on that helter-skelter zero draft. Start writing quickly. Do not edit as you go. And that's the biggest issue that people have. It's like we have as a writer, we have three roles we play. We play the role of, you know, the creator of the piece. We play the role of the organizer of the piece, putting things in the right order. And we play the editor or judge of the piece, you know, the person who is good at making the proper revisions. The problem is that like siblings in a family, you know, there's always one sibling that, you know, likes to be bossy. And in the writing family, the bossy part is the editor or the judge, who always wants to, you know, put a red pen to it or say, oh, you're stupid, or that's wrong, or that's not right. And when that editor enters the process too quickly, it doesn't leave much for the creator to do. And so you have to realize that the first part of that, the helter-skelter part, creating the zero draft, you have to just write anything. You have to write quickly, you have to not edit it, and you have to have a free hand in it, because then you will create more original material than you realize you could. And then the second phase is where the hocus-pocus organizing happens. And that's that, let's say, again, we'll take that hour that you have to write, that second set of 20 minutes, where you ask yourself, after you've written that zero draft, you start off that second phase of the process by saying to yourself, so what's my point? Or what am I trying to say here? And you look through that zero draft to find what that point is. If you haven't said it, well, now you probably can say it. So that hocus-pocus organizing phase is a phase where you partly begin to edit very slowly. That is, you might add information that you didn't have in your first draft, because as you're looking at it, you realize, oh, I didn't really say what I was really trying to say. But now I know what I'm trying to say, so I can say it. And you also look at the material and say, well, if that's my main point, if that's my bottom line, how do I prove it? And what you do then is you can get rid of some information that you wrote in your zero draft that you don't need, or you can add information that you realize you now need. And when that time is up, then you invite your ruthless editor to come back in and help you. I mean, that editor is a really important part of the process, but it's more destructive if it's at the very beginning of the process. And that's when I find people who have trouble writing, they really struggle over getting rid of that editor until the editor can be the best help to them. And the editor will then help them edit for content? Do I have everything in here that I need to have in? Do I have too much? What does my reader already know that my reader doesn't need to know? And then you read it a second time. Again, your editor is reading it for consideration of your audience, and that would mean the tone. Is there anything in here that would offend my audience? Have I said this in a way that talks down to my audience? Am I sarcastic? So you can read it for the tone and correct for that. You can read it a third time, and that would be to make sure that every word is needed in the sentence. Are you concise? Mark Twain once said, why should I use 4 words when I'm only getting paid for 2? So you edit for conciseness, and then last but not least, you edit for correctness. Is my grammar right? Is my spelling right? Is my punctuation correct? All the things that the editor would like to do at the very beginning of the process when the editor doesn't really need to be there. He needs to be there at the end. So it's that 3-phase process where you do the zero draft, you do the hocus-pocus organizing, and finally you do bring the editor back in to do the ruthless editing that I think makes for the ability to write quickly and well. What you do is you don't take any more time than you need or that you actually have for the process, but you divide that time differently.
You know, what strikes me as I hear you describe that process is that it's really about the story you tell yourself at each phase.
Yes.
In other words, okay, I'm writing this paper. I'm not going to be an editor. I'm not going to be the hocus pocus part of this. I'm just going to do a brain dump, if you
That's
will.
That's exactly right. In fact, some people will call it brain writing. It's everything you think you may want to include in that. In any particular, it doesn't have to even be in order. You can order it in the second phase, and you can edit it in the last phase. In fact, last week in a class, a student said in something that he was writing, he asked me to take a look at it, and he said, I hope that I have revised it properly, because revision is really the chance for you to read all your mistakes so that your audience won't have to. And I just loved that line that, you know, it's the last thing you do, not the first thing you do. And once you get that brained up, then you can kind of play with it and mold it and shape it the way a sculpture would until it begins to resemble something. And then, as I said, the art is in the revision.
You know, Wilma, as I listen to you talk about this, you obviously are a person who has a passion for helping others to learn how to write well. You've been around a while and teaching both thousands of students and business people about writing and presentations, a career of over 30 years. When you think about your influence on these people, how does that affect you?
It's the best psychic income anyone could want. And I think it's what keeps me doing what I do. Knowing that I can ease someone's pain, not really, well, maybe it's physical pain, but maybe it's more mental anguish, is something that is, it's indescribable. I believe truly that there's an author in all of us, and that somehow we've lost that ability. Many people have lost that ability to believe in themselves, and also to believe in the process, that what starts off as chaos often doesn't end up as chaos. And getting people to, you know, believe in themselves, believe in them, their subject, and believe that the process will take them from the beginning to the end and produce something that they can be proud of.